We don't have a slide for it, but I should probably tell you what we did first service. We had a baptism. And the two people who were baptized are Victor and Danilo. Now, I don't know if you know who they are. The fact is they do a huge amount in this congregation and serve in many different ways, but particularly between the video and the audio, they're very active in the congregation, and we appreciate it. In fact, Victor, one Friday night, came to the church and checked on the baptistry tank that was going to be a baptism the next day, and he noticed that the water was cold, and we like to have the water as warm as possible. We have a heater that's supposed to work, and so he called me, and we talked, and he ended up diving into the tank and having to do some things in the water in order to get cold water. And he did it. I mean, it's amazing to me what he's willing to do. And Danilo the same way. And all of the services, the funerals, the weddings, all the events, they help us out, and we really appreciate it. So we're very happy Victor and Danilo became members of the church today in through baptism, and we are glad for that. I want to put in context the verse that I've chosen to concentrate on today, and I want to restate it in the terms in the translation of the Bible that I use most of the time, and I prefer a majority of the time. It's the English Standard Version, and it says it this way. It says, "What does God require of you, man, but to do justly, love kindness, and walk humbly with your God?" The context in which Micah makes this statement is when he's talking about how the destruction of Jerusalem was going to take place and everything was going to fall apart. And then he comes back to remind the individuals what it was God was really looking for. It wasn't for all these sacrifices and these rituals and other things. He was looking for something else. Jesus, talking to his disciples, actually in Matthew 23, verse 23, quotes Micah 6, 8. He's talking to his disciples about the last day events. And as you know, he comes to chapter 24 and they begin asking the question, well, what's going to happen? What are the signs of what's going to be taking place there? And this is what Jesus responds in Matthew 24. He responds to them as verse 3, as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things be and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" And Jesus answered them, "See that no one leads you astray. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and they will lead many astray. But and you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are but the beginning of the birth pains." So Jesus begins to explain and to put into context as he's talking about the end of time, hence my title, Time is Up. What's taking place in the world around us? And frankly, as we look at the world, it's not a very comforting thought. I don't know about you, but it's to the place where the only news that I find I can listen to is those that are reported by the comedic pundits, because they put the news in the sense of humor that makes it palatable. If you sit and listen to the street news, it just raises the blood pressure. As my mother aged, she had difficulty with her blood pressure. And the doctor finally said, "Just don't watch the news." That helped. You don't know what's going on, you can't get worried about it. But the reality is that as we live in the time of the end, as we're coming to that, we need to keep one ear open, one eye on what's taking place, so that we're not caught unaware, so that we're not deceived by things that are going on and things that are being said. I'm not going to enter into the discussion of politics. That's a subject that I will not take from the platform, but if you want to talk to me afterwards, I'll tell you a few things about it, but I'm not going to say it publicly. But I do want to share with you some things that I did. It talks about wars and rumors of wars. So I went into the Google, just a simple thing, and wars. How many current wars are happening in the world today? Current. The statistics came out, some of them were in conflict, that's the internet. But the one that I picked on, and I want to share with you this morning, is there are 67 countries in the world at war. But listen to this. In those 67 countries, there are 713 factions or different groups that are fighting. So it's not just in the country one against another. It is all kinds of disruption that is taking place. That is absolutely phenomenal. I will give you the statistic, and that is that the United States is supporting 134 of those 713 factions. In 67 countries, that doesn't mean they do two per country. It means in some countries they may not support any, and in others they're supporting three or four factions. Wars. Majority of it has to do with terrorism. And I want to remind you that terrorism is not restricted to any geographical region. The fact is that we had here in December, on December 2 of 2015, right here in our back door, our front door, whichever way you're facing, a terrorist attack. And people in our community lost their lives. When it happened, my daughter was within a few blocks working at a Loma Linda University Medical Center clinic site. Pretty close to home, wouldn't you say? It's not just San Bernardino inside the United States. You have Paris and Brussels. You have air travel with planes simply disappearing. This week, another Egypt Air simply flying from Paris to Cairo disappears. They can tell, they can track, makes a left turn and then a spiral and drops from 37,500 feet and disappears at 10,000 feet. They're now picking up the debris. Fact is that the laws don't allow discrimination. And we like the fact that you can go as a Seventh-day Adventist anywhere and not be discriminated against because you want to worship on Saturday. The law protects us. But there's another side to that. You may not be comforted with this. I'm not here this morning trying to comfort you. I am here to disturb you. The fact of the matter is that after 9/11, a very good friend of ours, a friend whom, in fact, presented herself when we were pastoring in Hinsdale, Illinois, at the church one day, had seen my name associated with and showed up, and she said, "Are you any relation to George Keogh?" I said, "That's my grandfather." She says, "My grandfather was baptized by your grandfather in Egypt. And I saw your name here, and I decided I needed to reconnect with the Adventist Church. Would you rebaptize me?" So here we are with this friend, and we're getting acquainted, and we're going through life. We're doing what needs to be done. 9/11 happens, and she called us within a few days, frantic. She said, "I don't know what to do. I'm beside myself. I call the White House. I call the FBI. Nobody wants to listen to me." Probably too excited. They're not going to listen to somebody who's so excited giving information. But here's the story. Her daughter works for United Airlines. And she was reassigned to an airport in the Washington, D.C. area to work for the company there behind the scenes. And when she reported for work, as she was getting acquainted with the other people at the other airlines and around that worked and served at the airport, she discovered that there was a fairly large element of Arabic people with Arabic origins who were working at the airport, and they would all talk to each other in Arabic. It didn't take very long for the rest of them to discover that she was a Christian. They were not. And they immediately screened her out and would not allow her to be associating with them or to be in any way involved in what they were doing. And the frantic mother, hearing the story from her daughter, sees 9/11, wants to get the word out. They've infiltrated everywhere. And we go, It may be. I am thankful that the government of the United States is doing everything they can within our territories and even outside of our territories for flights that are coming in here to protect us as much as we can, as they can. And we are able to keep to a minimum. But the fact is, there are 67 countries, 713 factions, all fighting. And the world is not a safe place. It's not an easy thing to deal with. Let me share with you earthquakes. I'm going to share it to you in 38-year increments. 1863, right as the Seventh-day Adventist Church was forming and becoming organized legally, 1863 to 1900, the first 38 years, there were 12 earthquakes with a magnitude greater than 6.99. From 1901 to 1938, another 38-year span, there were 53 earthquakes greater than magnitude 6.99. 1939 to 1976, a 38-year span, there were 71 earthquakes greater than 6.99. 1977 to 2014, at the time this was being assembled, it was right before that end of that time period, and they were estimating that it would end with more than 190 earthquakes with a magnitude greater than 6.99 in that 38-year period. And don't think that you can move to the middle of the country and avoid earthquakes. They now have discovered that the fracking that they're doing in Oklahoma and Ohio and in other areas of the Midwest are causing the earthquakes. Furthermore, there are weather changes, and I'm barely touching that, but it talks about famines. What do you think we're dealing with in Southern California? We are dealing with loss of water, essential for life. Other parts of the country are having that, and as the weather systems begin to change, the weather patterns, we're finding violent storms. So go to the Midwest to avoid an earthquake, you'll still get them, and then you get the tornadoes on top of it. There's something else about earthquakes. I just have to say this, that by the way, the Bible never says there will be increasing in any of these events. It just says you'll hear rumors of wars and there will be earthquakes. It then talks about birth pangs, so some people want to interpret that as saying it gets more intense as time goes on before delivery, but it also says that's just the beginning. So I don't know where we fall in that spectrum. But there is in Scripture what's called a theophonic application for earthquakes. It's God's awesome power seen at Mount Sinai. What happened? An earthquake. In Acts, when the Holy Spirit comes down upon the people with flames of fire, the room shook. When Paul and Silas were in prison, there was an earthquake. There was the crucifixion, and the temple was shaken, and the curtain was torn from top to bottom. There was, at the resurrection, an earthquake, and the stone rolled away. The book of Revelation has five distinct earthquakes that it deals with, as all in the context of God's judgment, God's power, God's activity. Earthquakes, wars. There's an equal concern that I have, and that is the warning that is given prior to the statements, prior to that, and that is the rise of false gods who will deceive people and lead them astray. Stop and think about it in your own life, and the life that the world that you live in, and see the deception that is taking place and how people have now adopted other gods, things that are more important than God, material wealth, entertainment, whatever it is. We also find that Jesus in Matthew very clearly identifies that no one knows when Jesus is going to come. But it clearly identifies that there is a final judgment. And we find in Matthew chapter 25 the discussion of the final judgment, and what it does is consistent with what Micah 6:8 says, what Jesus said in Matthew 23, verse 23, quoting in Micah 6, and as he goes on, and one of the things that he calls for is not that in order to be ready for Jesus to come, that we have all of the prophecies nailed and exact. What Jesus calls for is a clear behavior that deals with how we work with one another, how we relate to people. The question is, if Jesus were to come, and Scripture has given us some indications as we look at the world around us, the reality is he could come any moment. And some of us plead for him to come. Are you ready? Will you meet the requirements that God has set for us? It's a clear test about what God requires in the final judgment. The first thing he says in Micah is, do justice. Dr. Zach Plantak was here a few weeks ago, gave an absolutely amazing sermon on this subject and quoted this text. If you haven't seen it and you weren't here, you need to go back to the website, pull it up, and listen to the sermon that he brought. It deals with the subject of justice, the Christian responsibility to be thoughtful of the needs of ourselves and others and the situations in which we find ourselves, and to do the right thing in a consistent manner. Second thing that I want to focus on this morning is the fact that the second part that God says he requires is that we love kindness. It's hard to define kindness sometimes because there are so many subtleties to it. It's an attribute of God that is not consistently found in human beings, but it is seen ultimately in God's salvation of mankind through Jesus, our Messiah. We should reflect on God's attributes. We should reflect God's attributes. We should be teaching kindness to our children through our own actions and be deliberate in our response to them, in our interaction with them. Simple little things that can be said, for instance, kind people think about other people's feelings. You don't need to scold a child, but in kindness respond and bring out the understanding of kindness and the experience of it. You can hang a poster in your home depicting or listing kind deeds that your family can do to one another. Be creative in the way that you share the principle of kindness, because what I am appealing us to do today in our world, it's not too late to become fluent in the language of kindness. It's a language. It's a way of communicating. And kindness overreaches all other languages that become barriers. Kindness goes beyond that in a way that is absolutely amazing. I'll tell you the story of Jorge Munoz. He's in New York City, school bus driver. He gets off work every day at 5 o'clock. When he gets off work, he goes down to the grocery stores and to the food banks, as he learned later on he could go to, and he gathers the food, then goes to his home, and the family gathers around, and they cook together. And they package all of the meals, each meal complete in its own unit. And then about 9:30 every night, they go to a specific subway station, the same subway station every night, and they hand out hot meals to the people who come. The first time he started doing it, there were 8 people that he found. They began spreading the word, and every night now it's over 150 people who come, and they give them the food. Not a wealthy person. He just has a person with a kind heart that sees a need, knows he has the ability to respond, and responds. There's the story of the 9 nanas. That's how they like to speak about themselves. They actually live in West Tennessee, not far from Graceland, the home of Elvis Presley. They begin their daily routine about 4 o'clock when they start sifting flour and washing eggs and getting things ready to bake. The fact is, these 9 nanas are not sisters, although they consider themselves sisters. Their birth certificates say differently. 4 of them were taken on, were actual grandchildren, and then either adopted or taken on by 2 individuals that all of them knew by the name of Mama and Papa. They were just grandparents whose heart saw a need, and they responded as they could. And after Mama and Papa had passed away, the 9 of these friends got together and they said, what can we do to carry on what they were doing? And they really remembered Mama's big specialty was a pound cake. They said, that's it. And they started meeting at 4 o'clock in the morning, making pound cakes that they would then give to people. If there was someone they saw an obituary or a service, a death notice in the paper, they would take it to them. Or if there was somebody ill that was reported somewhere, they would take it to them. They watched when they went to the grocery stores and they saw people who were going through and having a difficult time buying because they only had a certain amount of money and they needed ingredients and other things, and they would simply start filling their carts and they'd pay for it. They would travel at night. They did this surreptitiously. Nobody knew for 30 years. Not even their husbands knew what these 9 nanas were doing. Every day. They would do it at night and early in the morning, and then we would fade back into the fabric of life during the day. They noticed that some of the families that they would travel through the communities, some of them had no electricity. They could see candlelight inside, knew the power had been turned off. So they would go till they found out they could go to the utility company, and they didn't have to pay by name. They could pay by address, and they paid by address and paid for the light bill so it could be turned back on. Went around quietly with acts of kindness, fluent in the language of kindness. After 30 years of doing this, one of the husbands came one day and he had a bunch of bank statements, and he had highlighted on each of the statements. And he confronted his wife and he said, I just need to have an answer on this. I've been going through our statements and I realized it's a consistent pattern. I'm putting money in the savings account and you're taking it out, because I'm not taking it out. Where's all the money going? For the first time in 30 years, she had to confess to her husband what she and the other 8 nanas were doing. So they decided it was time to include their husbands. They got together with their husbands and they explained. The husbands added up. These 9 nanas had been doing over $900,000 worth of kindness in their community. They had no idea. They were just doing kindness because they saw the need and they wanted to respond. It's not just the 9 nanas. It's not just Jorge Munoz in New York City. It's people within our own community. We too are doing acts of kindness. Rachel and Frank go feed. Susie and Beth. Anytime anyone in this congregation has a death, they provide the reception for them so that they don't have to worry about it. Every time a group of you go down or individually to the Helping Hands pantry and help put things together, it's an act of kindness. It's speaking the language of kindness, sharing. Every time one of our adventurers goes to one of our elderly people, it's an act of speaking the language of kindness. What God calls us to is to love kindness, to embrace it, to speak it, to ooze it, to be. And it places this act of kindness in the context of the final end. And if you want to know whether you're good with God, check your language of kindness. Do justice. Love kindness. Walk humbly with your God. What I ask you this morning simply is to appeal, to become fluent in the language of kindness.